Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 1032, interview number 2 with Jim DiEugenio, author of Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on November 13th of the year 2018. And once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring back to our airwaves Jim DiEugenio, the author of the consummately important Destiny Betrayed and other titles. And I would mention at the beginning of the program something I will restate at the end. We are approaching holiday gift-giving season, and I think Destiny Betrayed would make not only a very good book for listeners to order. It gets the Dave Emery 5-star rating, but I think it would make an excellent holiday gift as well. I should stress, since this is non-commercial radio, I get no money whatsoever from this. Jim, welcome back to our airwaves.
Nice to be back, Dave. Thanks.
Now, we were talking in our first interview about how Kennedy's political vision and understanding of the desire of territories that had previously and for a long time been European colonies, colonies of countries with which the U.S. was allied in the Second World War, how they sought to become independent and how at the same time the U.S.'s recalcitrance in granting them their independence then projected these aspiring independent nations into the Cold War dynamic, obliging them, in part at least because of the Dulles and Eisenhower ethic of you're either with us or against us, obliging them to choose sides in the Cold War. We were speaking of a number of countries, and I don't think any nation, any struggle really epitomizes Kennedy's vision and how it went fundamentally against the Cold War inertia of the Eisenhower Dulles national security establishment, then the struggle for Algerian independence. If you would encapsulate that struggle for us and recap what we were speaking about at the end of our first talk, which was Kennedy's speech on the floor of the U.S. Senate, and I think it was 1958.
57.
Very good.
So the civil war in Algeria had been going on for about 3 years up to that time. See, and Kennedy, the reason this really kind of got under his skin is because he saw what France was doing in this situation as an echo of what had happened in Vietnam. In Indochina, at Dien Bien Phu, when Kennedy tried to go ahead and do something about that situation, he wasn't listened to. He was shunted aside, and Dien Bien Phu fell, and with it, the whole French Empire in Indochina sort of more or less collapsed. And so we had aided that situation, and now we're doing the same thing here. And he didn't understand it, okay? You know, and so he decided that he was going to make this occasion the accumulation of everything he had said and done up to that time on this issue of America in the Third World and what role America should really be playing. And so he took the floor, and he was not afraid to attack some of the luminaries in the White House and the State Department. And he said, look, if we were really the best friend of France, we would not be supplying her with helicopters and other kinds of weapons. All right. What we'd be doing is convincing her to go to the negotiating table and find some kind of decent way out of this mess, all right? Because the two things we should be concentrating on are, number one, to save the French nation, all right, and number two, to free Africa. And he even said, Didn't we learn this lesson back in 1954 when we did the same thing and we were on the losing side there? You know, why do we want to repeat this thing all over again? All right? Now, that this speech, it's very rare that a senator's speech raises a national furor. But this did. There were Kennedy's office clipped all the editorials that were printed in the newspapers across the country. If you can believe it, there were something like 168 editorials that were written in reply to this speech. They were 2-1 negative. All right? Kennedy was even criticized, not just by Eisenhower, Dulles, and Nixon. He was actually criticized by people in his own party, like Dean Acheson and Adlai Stevenson. All right? And he, once this tidal wave swept over him, he called up his father, and he said, you know something? Dad, I think I made a mistake here. You know, maybe I jumped the gun on this thing. And his father said, you don't know how lucky you are, because this thing is going to keep on getting worse and worse. And in a couple of years, you're going to look like a prophet. All right? And by the way, that's exactly what happened. Okay? By 1959, people like Eric Severide were saying, you know, John F. Kennedy's speech looks pretty good today, doesn't it? And he was on the cover of Time magazine, you know, and they talked about that speech. And he became, see, that speech, although it didn't do very well with the media in this country, was very popular in England, France, and especially Africa. Kennedy kind of became the unofficial ambassador to African dignitaries now. All right, and they actually listened, you know, the guerrillas in Algeria were listening to the voting results to the U.S. election, hoping Kennedy would win. All right? Now, there's another thing I should expound on this, and I'm sure you're aware of it. When Kennedy said, save the French nation, France was being racked by the pro versus con effort in the Algerian war. And, of course, the generals in Algeria, the high command in Algeria, was all for prosecuting the war. See, they looked at Algeria as not like Vietnam because Algeria was right across the Mediterranean Sea. They looked at it as a kind of extension of France, all right? And so they wanted to stay in, all right? And it was this struggle that caused the collapse of the Fourth Republic, and the return to power of Charles de Gaulle. And when de Gaulle ended up agreeing with Kennedy that we should begin to withdraw, these guys got really upset, and they attempted a number of assassination attempts on de Gaulle. And there's a Maurice Brooks Gatlin, who was a friend of Bannister's, Guy Bannister's in New Orleans, and was with him on the Anti-Communist League of the Caribbean, and he was also a friend of Howard Hunt. Okay, it's rumored that he actually sent money to this renegade kind of alumni association of Algerian veterans called the OAS. All right, a quite a large amount of money for that time, about $200,000, to finance one of those plots against de Gaulle. And there's even information that one of the people involved, a guy named Soutre, all right, was actually in the Dallas-Fort Worth area on the day that Kennedy was killed. So this is not just a foreign policy issue. There is certain connections here that, you know, may go right into the heart of the Kennedy assassination.
Just a couple of points. We will talk more about Guy Bannister. Our veteran listeners to this program know about the Bannister, quote, detective agency, unquote. And in future talks, we can talk about why I'm putting quotes about, around that. It really appears to have been, to a large extent, not only an intelligence front, but really sort of a center of fascist reaction against the American civil rights movement and other things. The struggle in Algeria really occasioned the sort of deep schism in France that Kennedy's policies around the world occasioned in the U.S., and the Organisation de l'Armée Secrète, the OAS, was basically a group of military leaders, many of whom had sympathies with Vichy France during World War II, and they sought the elimination by force of Charles de Gaulle. And I believe in The Devil's Chessboard, David Talbot has even suggested that some of these attempts were aided by elements of CIA. Maurice Brooks Gatlin was one of Bannister's investigators. He boasted of having been a conduit of CIA money to attempts on de Gaulle's life, of course, as was the case with so many of Guy Bannister's people and Guy Bannister himself. He wasn't around very long after 11/22/63 to confirm that. I think Gatlin went out of a fifth-floor hotel window in Panama, and the mortality rate among the operational players was was quite high. So Mr. Gatlin was not around for us to query after that. But again, I think one cannot emphasize how strongly what Kennedy said went against the political grain. And younger listeners really probably don't have the sense of just how ossified and reactionary Eisenhower's America was. I mean, maybe they get some idea if they look at some of the retro TV and see what Americans were digesting in terms of entertainment. It really looks, quaint would be a polite word, almost prehistoric in its manifestations. And for Kennedy to opine as he did on the floor of the U.S. Senate was absolutely radical, and that would, that in and of itself would have cast him as a screaming commie in the views of many. And many of the other anti-colonial struggles that Kennedy saw as not commie versus capitalist, but rather the desire of colonial peoples to gain independence, would have done much of the same thing. In our discussions, Jim, on this program with Ed Haslam, we have spoken about the city of New Orleans and how deeply involved it was not only with matters Latin American, but with Cuba. Of all of the former colonial areas that had at least nominally gained independence, none figures more prominently in Jim Garrison's investigation and in the involvement of many of the players that he looked into than Cuba. And I think before we even get into discussions of Castro and the attempts at ousting him and the Cuban Missile Crisis, developing some of the background of Cuba. In your book, you talk about how Cuba developed in the 20s and 30s and the relationship between Cuban power structure and Fulgencio Batista and corporate America. I wonder if you would lay that out for us.
See, there was a struggle in Cuba between the forces that backed Fulgencio Batista, who was essentially more or less a kind of fascist dictator, versus the democratic impulses there. And slowly but surely, Batista got rid by cracking down on the forces that were opposed to him. And he kind of went into office for a few years. Then he would retire to his home in Florida, let somebody else take over, like Prio Socorro's, all right? And then he would come back and run again, stay in power again for maybe 4 or 8 years, go back. But then in the 1950s, he pretty much decided to stay in power for a long period of time. And he essentially made Cuba a haven for American investments. And this gets, you know, in the movies and in popular parlance, this gets essentially translated into the mafia and their casinos. But there was a lot more than that going on in Cuba.
Indeed.
It was a haven for both, if you can believe it, ranching. The King Ranch had a tremendous amount of acreage. They call them hectares in Cuba down there. You're talking tens of millions of dollars.
By the way,
there was American industry located down there with a big company called Freeport Sulfur. You know, and I would see what Batista did is he decided to make Cuba a tax-free haven for American investments. So therefore, there was a whole fleet of diversified American investments in Cuba. I mean, what company doesn't want to pay, you know, who wants to pay taxes? Well, by making them tax-free, he attracted all these American investments there. And, of course, we know what happens is that you can get people in those kind of areas to work a lot cheaper than you can get Americans to work because there aren't any unions or benefits or government protection there, all right? And so during the 1950s, a whole panoply of American investments of all different kinds, including, of course, organized crime, you know, prospered in Cuba. And, of course, Batista did not protect any of his citizens against the abuses, right, that those kind of corporate and business interests were going to take. And so people literally had almost no economic rights and very little democratic rights under his regime. So slowly but surely, there began to be a resistance to Batista that first developed on the eastern end of the island. Okay, Fidel Castro and Che Guevara began their rebellion in the mountains of the eastern side of Cuba. And at first, it was really kind of slow going. And Castro was actually captured, you know, thrown into jail, etc. You know, but Batista made a bad mistake and he let him out. All right. And so this resistance picked up steam as time went on. And it began to spread from the eastern end of the island all the way over to the middle portion until finally began to lay siege to the western end where, of course, the capital, Havana, all right, was located. And I have to say, the American State Department did not do a very good job in measuring just what of a significant factor that the Castro Che Guevara forces were and the threat that they posed to overturning the Batista regime. And in fact, the people who finally alerted Eisenhower to this serious problem was A, the news media, and B, the corporate interests, all right, who had their investments there. Right, but it ended up being rather, to use a cliche, too little, too late. Right, and so when Eisenhower began to advise Batista that, you know, you better do something about this or you're going to be consumed by it. You know, Batista decided the better part of valor is to sack the treasury. And instead of putting up a battle, he went ahead and he left the country and went to Florida with something like $200 million, if I remember correctly. And that, of course, was provided. He didn't put up very much of a fight. Now, there was some fighting. I don't want to leave that impression. But it really wasn't much of a fight, right? And so I think it was New Year's Day in 1959 that Castro marched in to Havana, and he and Che Guevara became the new leaders of the island of Cuba.
You mentioned, by the way, very quickly, Jim, listeners might not be familiar with the King Ranch. That is an enormous cattle, oh, really corporation, but a huge entity in Texas.
In fact, I think it's the biggest ranch. At that time, it was the biggest ranching interest in Texas.
Yeah, it's huge.
It's literally hundreds of acres, you know, that it covered. And it had a very large investment, okay, in Cuba at the time. That guy was really upset about the growing threat, okay, to Batista. You know, he was one of the early guys who complained that the United States isn't doing enough to prop him up.
It was another major feature of the Cuban economy was sugarcane, which was both of interest to the mob. And there was a profound mob presence in Cuba with people like Meyer Lansky, Santos Tropicante, and others whom we can mention in future interviews. Sugar, obviously, is a major ingredient of the distilling industry. If you're going to make whiskey, sour mash often uses sugar. Rum uses sugar. And, of course, it also is a staple of the, well, not just American diet, but it is a huge factor in American food consumption and a major
right.
cash crop for Cuba. Something you mentioned, Jim, Batista instituted something called the BARC, I believe it was, his anti-communist, basically a Cuban Gestapo. And in Destiny Betrayed, you point out how the attitude of Che Guevara, who was a militant communist toward one of the key people in that organization, sort of embodied the schism between Castro's Cuba and not only the Batista regime, but also the American corporate backers, and through that, even behind that, the CIA.
Right, right. Batista backed this group, which was meant to hunt down all the leftists and communists on the island, and it's right, the acronym is BARC. And once Che Guevara and Castro took over, all right, they were determined to, these are some of the guys they put up against the firing squad. And when the CIA tried to, you know, get him out of there, the head of the BARC, he said, look, I would kill him simply because you want him back, but I have to kill him, you know, because of what he did to the people on my side. So there's no way I'm going to let him go. All right. And so there were about, I think the common number is that Che Guevara and Castro put like 400 people up against the firing squad, and he was one of the first that they decided to get rid of. All right. So that's the way that they felt about Batista's regime. And, of course, if Batista would have stayed, he would have been up against the firing squad also.
And again, the American paternal sponsorship of Batista and his people, I believe that the following question was actually trained in the U.S. And the cast of characters who were already manifesting in Cuba, even before the Bay of Pigs and things we will talk about, is the same cast of characters that we will also see later. They even emerged during Watergate. It wasn't until I read Destiny Betrayed that I was aware of E. Howard Hunt, the famed Watergate burglar and participant in the overthrow of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala, and his role in helping with William Pauley, also a luminary of the U.S. intel establishment, to sort of ease, to lubricate the exit of Batista, so to speak.
Right, right, that's correct. And they also tried to get somebody else in there, okay, that they thought would be a better ruler, but Batista didn't want to leave at that time. But they did convince him, you know, to leave later. Hunt was a major player in this whole CIA-Cuban nexus, as well as David Phillips was, all right? And it kind of goes back to their participation in the overthrow of Arbenz in Guatemala. That's where they kind of earned their stripes, and so they were then brought in to this situation, which did not have the same ending, of course, as the Guatemala excursion did. All right, but that's how far these guys go back. And by the way, I should mention, also in my book, after the overthrow of Arbenz, Ferry and Bannister went down to Guatemala to check on how Castillo Armas, you know, was running his new state. They were sent down there as this anti, you know, communist League of the Caribbean. So they were, these guys, what we're going to talk about in the future, you know, they go back a long way.
They do. David Ferry and Guy Bannister, both very active on behalf of U.S. Intel and CIA, although Bannister appears to have had connections, well, certainly with FBI and Naval Intel as well, ONI. People like David Ferry, we will get to Clay Shaw in future talks, and Bannister were deeply involved not only with Cuba, but that whole cast of characters, David Phillips, about whom we will have more to say later, Tracy Barnes, big Bay of Pigs player, was also a major player in the Arbenz coup. So the cast of characters for the overthrow of Arbenz in Guatemala then manifests in Cuba, and in future talks we will see how they come to play in the Kennedy assassination and how Jim Garrison began to fit the pieces of that jigsaw puzzle together, and how the New Orleans cast of characters figured into the murder of Kennedy and the reversal of so much of what Kennedy was working toward. Kennedy, of course, was elected president in the 1960 election and was inaugurated on January 20th of 1961. He inherited plans from Eisenhower for an invasion of Cuba, which culminated in the Bay of Pigs. I wonder, Jim, if you would set forth for us the evolution of the military invasion plans for Cuba. In particular, not only how they evolved, but the deep flaws, simply from an operational standpoint, and how the whole question of air power figured into these plans, because that was a major issue in terms of the casting of Kennedy as the villain, the subverter of this operation.
Yeah, I devote a whole chapter to this in my book, you know, which I the title of that chapter is Bay of Pigs, Dulles versus Kennedy. All right. As you mentioned, this was originally devised under Eisenhower, and Richard Nixon was the action officer for the Bay of Pigs invasion in the White House. He dearly wanted this to happen, all right, before the election, because he quite naturally saw himself accumulating a lot of credit for it if it did. Eisenhower didn't want to authorize it at that time because he did not think that there was a practical government in exile, an effective governing exile to take over the country at this time. And at that time, I have to say, as almost every observer has pointed out, the eventual plan was not what it was at that time. At that time, it was supposed to be a kind of armada of guerrilla exiles, the original plan, that were going to go ahead and infiltrate onto the island and hook up with other dissident groups. But the problem was that as time went on and Eisenhower delayed it and delayed it, there were no, because Castro had cracked down on these alleged dissident groups that were hiding in the mountains and, you know, in the hills, etc. So that kind of went by the boards. And then in the transition from Eisenhower to Kennedy, the people who were running the operation, which would be Alan Dulles and Dick Bissell, the deputy director of plans, transformed it into a completely different concept, which was now going to be, as they envisioned it, a kind of strike force operation. In other words, it was not going to be a scattered bunch of guerrilla exiles. It was going to be a kind of concentrated invasion, beachhead type of invasion, with about 1,400 of these Cuban exiles that they had trained in Florida, New Orleans, and in Nicaragua. And they set forth from Guatemala, all right? And there had been an airstrike, okay, a few days before, which did not take out all the planes that the planners of the operation felt were necessary to take out. See, as you very astutely mentioned, there's been a long debate about whether or not there was supposed to be D-Day airstrikes. In other words, the morning of the invasion, where there's supposed to be another airstrike on that day. I did a lot of research on this, and I found a lot of different sources. There was no such D-Day airstrike that Kennedy approved, and the CIA knew that. And in fact, there is a memo that I found about a month before the operation in which they say, we have to change the landing area because Kennedy wants us to have a landing strip from the island to launch airstrikes. So that's one of the reasons they changed it to the Bay of Pigs, because there was a nearby strip that would have been good for launching airstrikes from the island. All right? So when this thing, Kennedy approves it, and believe me, Dave, he did not really like this at all. It was kind of pushed on him. All right? Even Alan Dulles said, you know, Kennedy treated this like a kind of orphan child that really wasn't his own. He never embraced it. He never liked it. All right? And so, but he felt that, you know, with all these guys in training for all these months, they kind of, Dulles told them, you're going to have a disposal problem. What are you going to do with all these guys? You know? And so he reluctantly decided to pull his cabinet. And I think there were 21 people there that day. And the only person who voted against it was a guy who wasn't even supposed to be there. Senator William Fulbright. He was the only guy who raised his hand and said, no, we shouldn't do it. Everybody else said, okay, I think we should go ahead. And so Kennedy gave the order to go ahead and launch it. And there was very, very little chance it was ever going to succeed in the first place. But see, what happened is that Castro had spies all over Central America, and they had set up observation posts around the island. And there was a police force at the Bay of Pigs. So the whole idea that Dulles sold Kennedy on, that there was going to be an element of surprise, That didn't turn out to be true. There was, and they went ahead and rang the alarm, and Castro, who had been supplied with all kinds of weapons from the Soviet Union, like tanks and mortars and cannons, etc., he got all this stuff to the front within just a matter of hours. All right? Plus, there was a reef there, which they didn't know about, and one of the, their ammo boat sank, okay? And so it was almost a lost cause from the very beginning, all right? And then when you had these planes coming overhead, all right, within about 48 hours, it was more or less over, all right? And so Kennedy did all he could to get as many of the wounded and the survivors off the beach. And by the third day, the rest of them had surrendered. Now, the other problem that Kennedy perceived is that Dulles had also told him that there would be defections, all right, coming over to the Cuban exile side. Well, there were none. There were absolutely none. Dulles also said that even if it fails, we can go ahead and send these guys in into the hills, and they'll act as a guerrilla force. Well, there was 70 miles of swamp between the Bay of Pigs and the nearest hills that they could have hit in. So there was no way they were going to be able to traverse that 70 miles and become a guerrilla force.
They would have had to drain the swamp in the parlance of our time.
They would have needed Donald Trump down there.
Yeah.
All right? And so the thing was absolutely hopeless. And so Kennedy is very upset, and he launches a White House investigation called the Taylor Commission, and the CIA does their own internal report by Lyman Kirkpatrick, the inspector general. And Bobby Kennedy is on the Taylor Commission. And he ends up being, you know, all those years he was a prosecutor, all those years he was an investigator. Well, he really went after Alan Dulles on this because he simply didn't believe him. He said, you're going to tell me that you thought a force of 1,400 men were going to defeat a combined force between the regular army, which is 30,000, and the reserves, which is 100,000. You're outnumbered there by about 100-1, which is the absolute opposite of what you're supposed to be with amphibious operation. You have to outnumber the other side. All right? So then he goes out and he says, how could these guys turn guerrilla if, A, you did not give them any guerrilla training, and that's what he found from some of these witnesses, and B, the hills are 70 miles away. You know, and Dulles really didn't have any kind of answer. Well, they could have just made it up as they went along, et cetera. You know, it ended up that Bobby Kennedy didn't believe that Dulles and Bissell ever thought it was going to succeed. All right? So he called in a guy named Robert Lovett, who had been, I think he was JFK's first choice for Secretary of Defense because he was a friend of Joe Kennedy's. And Joe Kennedy said, you should talk to this guy, because Lovett and David Bruce tried to get Dulles fired during the 50s, and they couldn't do it because his brother was protecting him. So they brought in Lovett, and Lovett was interviewed by Bobby Kennedy and said, look, we hated what Dulles did to the CIA, and we wrote a report on this, you know, saying, you know, why? What gives us the right to barge into these third world countries, you know, and corrupt the opposition and try and take over their governments? And it always ends up for the worst for the people there. And so he went ahead and got an interview between Lovett and JFK. And Lovett said, look, in my opinion, Dulles knew this was going to fail. And what he was relying upon was for you to lose your nerve and wanting to avoid embarrassment, you would send in the Navy to bail it out, even though you had said 9 days before there will be no American intervention in Cuba. You know? And so that convinced JFK not only to fire Dulles, but he fired Dulles, Bissell, and the deputy director, Charles Cabell.
Whose brother Earl was the mayor of Dallas when Kennedy was killed. Procedure.
And he was a CIA asset. We just found that out about 8 months ago.
Aha, okay. Well, that it fits like another piece of the jigsaw puzzle that you have been fitting together, and certainly makes all the sense in the world. One observation I have very quickly, Jim. You write in Destiny Betrayed about how Dulles and the whole team were telling Kennedy that the Cuban people would rise against Castro and that Castro was losing popularity. It reminds me of the PR that was done before the invasion of Iraq by George W. Bush, where it was bandied about that the U.S. Troops would be hailed as liberators and showered with garlands of flowers, and neither was the case. So this is a type of misrepresentation that has endured through the decades.
Right. And one other thing here. During the Taylor Commission proceedings, Howard Hunt was the attaché to Alan Dulles during those things. And Dulles and Hunt began to see the writing on the wall, you know, that Bobby Kennedy was going to recommend that Alan Dulles be canned because of this. So relating to what you just said about our compromised media, they brought in a guy named Charles Murphy, from Fortune magazine, of course, which meant he was an employee of Henry Luce of Time Life, right? And they put out this cover story that it wasn't really the CIA's fault, right, that the operation had failed. And that's how this whole mythology about the cancellation of the D-Day airstrikes, that's how it took place over a big six-page story in Fortune magazine. And when Kennedy saw that story, he was livid. And Charles Murphy was, a reserve officer in the Air Force. He stripped him of his officer command. And Murphy, I'll never forget when I discovered this, writing to a friend, I think it was Lansdale, he said, Kennedy stripped me of my Air Force reserve status, but I really didn't mind because my allegiance was not to him. It was to Alan Dulles.
And you point out in Destiny Betrayed that Alan Dulles was very much involved with, sort of was the journalistic or literary stage manager of Charles Murphy's piece in the Henry Luce-owned Fortune magazine.
Right, right. And I wouldn't be surprised if Dulles had Hunt, you know, write the first draft
right
under his supervision, you know, and then they just gave it to Murphy to do had a polish, you know, and then put it under his name, you know. And so when I read that, and this was many years ago that I discovered that letter, you know, it really hit home to me that there's really people like that, you know, in the journalistic establishment who don't look upon the president as being the real commander-in-chief, you know? And so I think that's something that you said earlier, that we have to understand what's going on in the MSM.
We rely on the media to tell us the truth, at least in theory. One of the things in the Charles Murphy piece in Fortune exemplifies, and I think in terms of the development of your book and what we will talk about in future interviews, in particular with how Jim Garrison, although he made some operational mistakes in terms of the way he went about his investigation, He basically is, in my opinion, a genuine hero, and he very successfully went against this tsunami of national security power and outright lies, and one that is absolutely deadly when it chooses to be so. And his, in addition to the murder of JFK, Jim Garrison's character was assassinated, but in the media by people who were functioning in conjunction with the intelligence community and subverting Anglo-Saxon law in a most profound way. We'll get to people like Walter Sheridan and others in future interviews. We probably will not have time. We've got a little less than 15 minutes for this talk, Jim. But I think a couple of things to point out to people, and that is what exactly the Taylor report, that was from General Maxwell Taylor, engendered in terms of NSAMs 55, 56, and 57. And also, you develop in Destiny Betrayed how the one Cuban element that might conceivably have been able to rally popular support were the followers of Manolo Rey. And you talk about how Dulles and company saw Manolo Rey and perhaps what they were even prepared to do to his followers if they could have been successful. Let's start with the Taylor Report and what it did with NSA's 55, 56, NSAM's 55, 56, and 57, because that in many ways really set in motion the machinery that was to result in the coup in Dallas and to claim Kennedy's life.
See, one of the criticisms of the Taylor Report, what they said, is that this operation just got too big for the Central Intelligence Agency to run. It really should have been a combination Pentagon-CIA operation. See, but the CIA didn't want it to be that, okay? And so one of the things they said is that you should go ahead and make recommendations about how covert operations are going to be run in the future. And so as a result, Kennedy drafted NSAMs 55, 56, and 57. 55 said that he was very upset, and from here on in, he wanted the direct input of the Joint Chiefs into all these major kind of paramilitary operations in the Cold War. And this was really a kind of shot across the bow, you know, to the CIA, all right? In fact, it was the beginning of their sole control over paramilitary operations. There was also supposed to be, in 56, an order to make an inventory of all paramilitary assets and equipment the Pentagon had on hand that we could supply to these covert operations all over the world. So he was going to make them accountable for the supplying of these operations. And then 57 said that all paramilitary operations had to be presented to an outside group, all right, called the Strategic Resources Groups, and they would assign a person and a department to run it. The CIA was only to be involved in paramilitary operations that could be wholly covert and disavowable. And so this really limited the CIA's ability to ever do again an operation like this invasion of Cuba. And it began to take away power from the Central Intelligence Agency, which had been the number one paramilitary group up to that time, and redistributed. And Kennedy eventually created something called the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, as a way of taking away some of the CIA's power in these operations. All right, and that was created by McNamara in 1962. So this was really the beginning of a battle for turf, you know, between the White House and the Central Intelligence Agency. All right, now, one of the things that really disturbed Kennedy was that he found out through Arthur Schlesinger and White House aide that the CIA had essentially kind of trapped and imprisoned his favorite group of Cuban exiles, led by the leftist Manuel O'Rey. And somehow they got a message at the White House, and so he sent Arthur Schlesinger down to Opa-locka Air Base down in Florida, and he found these guys, you know, essentially under armed guard. And the guard actually had firearms on him. Okay, and so he stopped Schlesinger and said, look, I'm here from the White House. President Kennedy wants these people released ASAP. All right? And if you don't believe me, call them, and they'll tell you. And a lot of people believe, including myself, that this was part of what they call Operation 40, which was a secret covert operation buried within the Bay of Pigs, that if the Bay of Pigs succeeded, it would do away not just with Castro and all the people running that government, but also the leftists that Kennedy demanded be part of the Bay of Pigs operation. E. Howard Hunt resigned over having Manuel O'Rey included in the Bay of Pigs because he said it was, you know, Castroism without Castro. But Hunt was going to be a part of the fly-in group that if the operation succeeded, he was going to be a part of it. All right, now, one last thing. Silvio Odio, who was visited about 7 weeks before the assassination by what appeared to be two Cubans and Oswald, she was a part of Manuel O'Rey's group, which was called Jure.
By the way, that's
called... We can talk about that in depth later, what that really means, I think.
Sure.
All right?
Jure, by the way, spelled J-U-R-E for people that
Correct,
are listening.
Yes.
This, when I get the written description for these interviews published, that will be in there. An early plug is we've got about a little over seven minutes left. Ordering the book both for yourselves, listeners, and making it a holiday gift-giving selection, I think, would be an optimum course to pursue. And reading about these things, we have been going into things in relative depth. I want to emphasize that in the actual volume of Destiny Betrayed, there is far more and, frankly, exhaustive detail and something that I personally very much like. It is rigorously scholarly. There is an abundance of footnotes, and so these points of information rest on an irrefutable bedrock of documentation. Manolo Rey, again, was one of the few Cuban exiles who actually have a popular following in Cuba, and you have written that it looks like there is information pointing in the direction of the liquidation of Manolo Rey's followers in Cuba had the invasion have been successful. Develop that for us. I also have a question. You mentioned that a guy named Felix was a person who may have figured in that possible liquidation in Operation 40. Have you ever encountered whether that was Felix Rodriguez of Iran-Contra fame? Because he plays throughout so many different national security scenarios after the Cuban embroglio.
No, I don't think it was Felix Rodriguez.
Okay. But what was going to happen to Rey's followers again if they had been successful in invading Cuba?
All right. Operation 40, and I can't say this for certain, but from the accumulation of evidence that I have, all right, it appears that Operation 40 was supposed to essentially eliminate the leftist members of the Bay of Pigs invasion, all right, and also Rey himself, all right, so they would not have... See, Kennedy forced Rey on the CIA. I don't know if many people know that, but he insisted that if we're going to go ahead with this thing, I want Manuel O'Rey on the board of our exile government, and I want his followers to be a part of it. And he ended up being one of the best witnesses against Dulles during the Taylor Commission hearings. All right? And Bobby Kennedy really got close to him during that series of hearings because, you know, he essentially said, look, these guys, this wasn't a Cuban operation. This is a CIA operation. I would have never agreed for this strike force idea off the Bay of Pigs. I wanted to go in at the Isle of Pines, which is on the southern coast, and then make that our base and then invade the mainland, you know? So, yeah, you're exactly right. From what I can put together, Manuel O'Rey was scheduled for termination, you know, if the Bay of Pigs succeeded.
And we will talk about the Sylvia Odio incident at greater length in the future. Jim, we've got about 4 minutes left. There is much more to talk about with regard to Cuba. Of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis, where once again Kennedy went against the grain, the national security grain, and perhaps in an even more, certainly a more weighty context, because what was at stake was World War III. And we'll talk about that. And then as if the things that we have spoken about in our two interviews so far had not cast Kennedy as a card-carrying commie in the eyes of the powers that be at that time, or that were at that time, and sadly many still are, what he attempted to do with a rapprochement with Castro would have absolutely carried a death sentence for him in the eyes of so many of the players that we have been speaking about, people like Ferry Shaw. And indeed, in the Cuban scenario, so many of the people that we will discuss in future interviews, not only Guy Bannister and David Ferry, not only Clay Shaw, but people like Gordon Novell, Sergio Arcacha Smith, Antonio Venciana, the aforementioned E. Howard Hunt, James McCord, who Howard Hunt figured in the Watergate situation, the aforementioned David Atlee Phillips. All of these people will... rather like Shakespeare's The Tragedy of Julius Caesar, they will come to the fore and their bloody hands and bloody daggers will be held high as they walk into the Senate in the future, referring, of course, to that famous scene in Shakespeare's play. And we will talk about how the whole Cuban dramatis personae were then unearthed by Jim Garrison, and also some of the other aspects of the Cuban situation. However, we have about 2 minutes left. I want to reiterate, Jim, that I think people could do no better than to get your book and not just read it, but study it. And even more, the holiday gift-giving season is upon us. This would make a superb gift for people who want to educate those about whom they care. Tell us how to get the book. Tell us about your website. And tell us about Black Op Radio for people who would perhaps like to interact with you to a greater extent.
Okay, it's KennedysandKing.com is my website. It's a wonderful compendium of research articles, book reviews, and news. And you can order Destiny Betrayed and my other book, The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today. Destiny Betrayed is kind of like a macro view of the Kennedy assassination, a big picture thing, whereas the other book, The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today, is kind of a micro view of the, it goes into all the details of analysis of the evidence. All right. And I'm on Black Op Radio, which is out of Vancouver, Canada, about every other week or every third week, and I answer a lot of questions on that particular program. People still are very, if you can believe it, these people are still very interested in the details, you know, of the Kennedy assassination, even though the MSM does everything they can to stamp it out. But there's still people like you and him who keep this alive.
All righty. Well, hopefully this will spur people on to greater efforts. We have been speaking with Jim DiEugenio, the author of, among other titles, Destiny Betrayed, and the maven of the Kennedys and King website. This concludes interview number two, for the record, program 1032, interview number two with Jim DiEugenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on November 13th of the year 2018. For Jim DiEugenio, this is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.